Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and distinctive perspectives to help prepare church leaders, preachers, pundits, proclaimers for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today, as usual, is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello.
Hello. Good to be back with you.
It's wonderful to be back with you both. Looking forward to our discussion. This is the last Sunday of Epiphany in the Revised Common Lectionary Year B, and it leads into directly Ash Wednesday. And we can see this in a obvious way because the collect identifies the passion of God's only Son revealed in glory upon the holy mountain. And so the readings for today point out epiphanies of different sorts in different parts of the Bible. The one in the Hebrew scriptures is the account of Elijah being taken up to heaven by a whirlwind and what that might look like from the ground up. Pretty exciting. It's got to do with chariots, and Merkava mysticism became something in Jewish tradition upon which it was not prudent to speculate. Merkava chariot mysticism. Anyway, that's Elijah being taken up into heaven. So Elijah, chariots, horsemen, Elisha, his disciple, witnessing it from below. Psalm 50 talks about the revelation of God in glory from Zion, and that makes absolute sense because that fits the revelation of all of the materials from Scripture in these selections. And I'm not sure about 2 Corinthians directly, but it is a reference to the partial revelation of the gospel. But the language is metaphorical. Even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. And that of course is so that those who witness it are kept from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. It's kind of a veiling protection, because it's too difficult for human beings, as it is in the case of something like an eclipse, to look directly at the thing that is being revealed, the person that is being revealed, the chariot that is being revealed to take somebody away. So, I mean, I might have chosen, for example, Paul's own account of his being caught up into one of the heavens, which is the basis for his own mystical experience of God and presumably, you know, a source of his sense of vocation in the traditions of following God in a different way and inserting Jesus into that process. But the gospel, of course, focuses on the transfiguration of Jesus in Mark 9, and it is witnessed by Peter, James, and John. So there we get a selection of three disciples, and with and alongside Jesus is Elijah and Moses. Peter says some unexpected things, but so would anybody in that kind of situation. He didn't know what to say. They were terrified. A cloud overshadows them. From the cloud comes a voice, very much like the baptism, now in the third person, not the second person. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. And when they look around, only Jesus is there. So this whole selection of readings is absolutely focused on revelations of God, revelations to people, and the effect that they have, these revelations have on people. And I think the element of transcendence, what do we do in the light of descriptions of transcendent experience, or indeed our own transcendent experiences that might well be transformative in our lives? Okay, enough of me. What do you think?
I'm thinking that last question you left us with is one well to be contemplated, because it has such affinity with all the texts that we're reading, that it's the note of epiphany, but also kind of corollary veiling, but more so epiphany. And to contemplate that down the, maybe a little further on, how our own senses of epiphanies, our own experiences of epiphany correlate with what we have here, and how does it enter into the into our common human experience. And I name that because I think for many Christians, especially in our historical churches, this kind of epiphany is sort of a taboo conversation that we're very hesitant about, and perhaps makes it a little difficult to talk about our convictions around experiences when we feel we have seen something that doesn't have to be mystical, but something that's life transforming in our experience. So to bring that into, to bring our personal experiences into conversation with these texts might be very helpful.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. My first response here, I think, is to recognize the connection between the baptism of Jesus and in this experience, in terms of the words spoken over him, the beloved Son. I think it's an interesting thread that's tied through here, and this kind of experience. You mentioned Merkava mysticism.
Yep.
That too is such an interesting part of this. I've always found that I don't know that I've always, but ever since I learned about that, I've always thought, wow, that seems to me to be something behind the text here that we don't really have access to. Some kind of, you know, I mean, what sort of practices did Jesus share with Elijah and Elisha and then the two disciples here, right? Peter and James, or three, Peter, James, and John. Mm-hmm. In the sense that I say practices because we imagine in the way, from the narrative, that this is just something that happened. But, you know, what is if it's tied to, you know, a set of practices like prayer or something like that, which mm-hmm. as Merkava mysticism itself mm-hmm. is, right? Mm-hmm. And so those are things that I always find interesting, the ways in which you can kind of bring these extraordinary events down to something that emerges out of the mundane, I guess.
And I find it very encouraging that you make that kind of connection, Josh. That it's not dependent upon having LSD in the system necessarily. You know, but that there are very mundane experiences that can lead to transportations that mm-hmm. are unaccustomed and unusual mm-hmm. in our experience. And I will say again that to some extent, in the concreteness of our spirituality, you know, what I'm getting at is that I could not see myself readily standing up in my Methodist church today and saying, you know, the Lord, as Paul did, the Lord transported me to seventh heaven. And while I was there, I saw this and that and all kinds of things that you would never believe on earth. I and actually on my way down, I saw this chariot ascending with some personage in it or other. If not immediately, I think I would have to look over my shoulder for the ambulance coming to take me out mm-hmm. of that situation. And that's what I mean partially by taboo. And when we think of the limitations we put on our prayer experiences and where those could lead us, where we might need language like this that we see in Elijah or that we're seeing in the Transfiguration narrative, where we might need language like that to talk about the experience, there's an anxiety, I think, about going there into those spaces. And I have that anxiety too, let me not pretend, but that you can connect it, that Josh connects it to the ordinary, to the mundane, is an important handle to hold on to. Because when you look at the Elisha Elijah, Elisha narrative. It's very earthbound until it is not.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And then when it's not, it's really not. You know, it's going to heaven in a chariot of fire.
Right? Yeah.
For what it's worth, in verse 6, when Mark 9 describes the reaction of Peter speaking for the three disciples to what they have seen, the English, and behind it the Greek, has a funny little connection to the empty tomb of chapter 16. So there's something numinous about this passage. It's epiphanic, it's transfigured, and it reduces people to incoherence. And the explanation Mark gives, which is the connection to Mark 16, is Peter didn't know what to say, for they were terrified, for they were afraid. They said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid, is how the gospel ends in Mark 16:8. So there's an interconnection of this to the empty tomb. Now, Josh, the empty tomb on a simple level is simply absence. Mm-hmm. It's not epiphanic. It's just the discovery of the absence where you thought or you anticipated there would be a presence, right? Mm-hmm. So making something of what is not there as a connection to baptism, something that's happening, or as a connection to transformation, transfiguration, something that you see, is this interlinked theme in Mark's gospel. And Mark never tries to explain epiphanies or empty tombs or baptisms, but here they are as little drop points in the narrative. And I mean, the thing that I'd just like to say about that kind of experience, Althea, you were encouraging reflection on those kinds of experience we hear about or even that we know in our lives. Just the sheer facticity of being there is the ground for this whole experience. I mean, I know this is a bit banal, but getting up in the morning and going to watch the sunrise, you know, if you think it's going to be a particular sunrise that is something you can see and not hidden behind clouds, just being there is all it takes. That's all it takes. But if you're not there, you missed it. So that's a place to start, awareness and consciousness.
Yeah. I wonder though, Deirdre, to strengthen the tie a little bit that you're making, at least that's my hope, going back to the connection to Mark 16, is it possible to see an occluded epiphany in the tomb experience? Because the person they see is a young man dressed in a white robe who does not identify himself as Jesus. But what's the strangeness about encountering that person there who can also authoritatively tell the women mm-hmm. Where to go to look for Jesus
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. to give them a kind of prototypical missional directive? Go tell his disciples and Peter that he's going ahead of you to Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have also the terror and amazement,
yep,
suggesting that for them this is an extraordinary experience akin yep. to the Transfiguration.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to be there.
Yep.
And be prepared to be terrified.
Yeah. I've been at sunrises with complete strangers. It's not that Maine is overpopulated, so I'm not likely to run into lots of people, but a lot of people in Maine get up extremely early so that by the time the sun rises, you know, a good chunk of the day is over. But the experience of being with strangers in my tiny sense of these things is that you can talk freely about what you are seeing because it is so dominating. In other words, seeing a young man at the empty tomb is not, yes, but there are other young men in Mark's gospel, Althea, from the narrative point of view. We can see a young man in Gethsemane who ran away naked. So there are these strange figures that are surprising and repetitive and not surprising. But they signal something numinous, something. I'm not saying they're angels at all. They're just figures that haven't been explained. Because that's what happens at epiphanic experiences. There are figures that aren't explained. There are servants in the Elijah narrative, you know, and they're having a reaction to the epiphany of the chariot.
Yeah. The resurrection piece that because it's not Jesus's resurrection, but it's implicit in Mark, is that what expansive understanding of resurrection would we need to have in order to explain Elijah's and Moses's presence there talking with Jesus? Is it, if not resurrection, is it a kind of post-mortem life that we're looking at there? And in these texts, how is that liminal space between the concreteness of life as we have it here and the etherealness of the other side? How close do they come? And that liminal space is can we talk about that in terms of thin space where spirituality and materiality meet and become aware, and at least our material existence becomes aware of that spiritual on the other side kind of experience. So the two pieces there are is there an afterlife seen in the presence of Elijah and Moses? And how thin is this space between our known existence and that other unknown existence?
Yeah, this is a topic of significance in the New Testament, because we come at it from Paul and we come at it from the Gospels and from Revelation, which opens up with the scene in the throne room.
Yeah.
So the interconnections. Luke is different, because what Luke seems to do in describing the resurrection as a preface to the ascension is developing that whole sojourn of time in an extended time period from resurrection to ascension, which then leads to further ascent. So it's clearly of interest to New Testament writers. But Mark is almost least interested in it, except as a kind of disclosure of secrets, disclosure of mystery.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that we have begun talking about this and it's become a discussion of the resurrection and the ascension and these things too, because it's that which seems appropriate, because I think that's part of what this moment is a glimpse into the, I don't know how to put it, like the eternity of what is disclosed in the life of this person, and the way that these moments of this life intersect with the lives of others in this history. Like the way, you know, you have Moses and Elijah and the story of Elisha and Elijah and all of this, it all kind of converges here in a way where there is a profound intersection between this person and those figures, but there's also callbacks to his baptism. So you can see his resurrection in this moment. You can see his resurrection in his baptism. You can see the transformation in the baptism. You can see the transformation in the resurrection. it's like they're glimpses into, and there's an intersection here too with the way in which the figures intersect. It seems like it's like what, like in Luke, when they're walking on the road with him and they don't recognize him, and then they do recognize him in the breaking of the bread.
Yep.
They're talking about scripture the whole, I mean, that's what he's doing, is he's breaking open the scripture for them. And then they don't, but they don't see it until the bread is broken. And it's like something like that happens with the resurrection, something like that happens on the mountain of transfiguration, something like that happens in the baptism. And I guess that's what I kind of meant by these extraordinary events in the mundane. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. It's like, there you are doing something that you do every day, but this day it's extraordinary because somehow the pieces fell together and time and eternity broke into time. And you're like, oh, I get it. Or something like that. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And the same thing with this empty tomb. From one perspective, it's just an empty tomb. But from another, it's the linchpin that makes all the pieces fall together.
Exactly. Exactly. And Luke is a maximalist on this topic, and Mark is a minimalist. Yeah. So we have a range of responses.
and who is John? John is what, like the
John wants it all. John wants it all.
Yeah.
It's incarnation from the word go. So it's more of the other. It's more transcendence than you can almost possibly bear. And it's pretty incoherent. I mean, who understands Jesus in John's gospel? Not the people with whom he's in dialogue.
It's everything in the kitchen sink, right?
That's it. That's how I see it. I'm sure that's why Episcopalians love John. Let's just have the whole shebang.
But I have been wondering, I don't have a landing place, but I've been eager to hear your thoughts on say the sacrament of the Lord's Supper in this conversation as a connecting place where eternity and time, ancestors and the present meet up, and where they ultimately, or maybe extremely, the resurrection of Jesus becomes realized.
Yep.
In that moment.
Well, it's great. It's a great question, Althea. So I'll just follow it, just as a contribution. So when Paul talks about, and I'm going to Paul because I want to be sure we capture the scope of all of the New Testament. In 1 Corinthians, he says, on the night that he died, Jesus took bread. But of course, Jesus, when eating with the disciples on this occasion, only in 2020 hindsight did it turn out to be the night before he died. Whereas in John, Jesus knows when he's going to die, right? So everything becomes prescient. Whereas in 1 Corinthians, before the Gospels, nothing is prescient. It just emerges in hindsight. And yet, 1 Corinthians 11 is a connecting link. It's one of the few links we get between Paul and the Gospels. Because what is marked is what Josh is describing at as a mundane thing, to eat together, whether it's Passover or not, to eat together, to break bread. On this occasion, they were in a different place. In 1 Corinthians, they're reenacting it in Corinth, whereas in the Gospels on the Passover, it's in Jerusalem in some strange house. So you see, Josh, how the shifting setting begins to make it more than an ordinary meal in hindsight. So I'm just trying to build on both of your observations.
Right. And it would seem that one of the things that obviously we've gone far afield from the actual lectionary readings, but it's entirely appropriate here because that's partly what we're discussing, is the way that this event sort of is itself it's shaped by the world of scripture and the recognition of things that are happening as they're connected to those things. I suppose that's kind of what I'm getting at. I don't know if that was clearly stated, but mm-hmm. but in the case of like the breaking of the bread in Luke, it's sort of like always seemed to me like a recognition of some sort of almost like an aesthetic recognition of the connection between all of these things that were discussed in relationship to scripture and how they converge in this extraordinary way in this event of the death of this man as a criminal.
Yep.
The Passover, the figure of Isaac, the Exodus, all of these things, suddenly with reference to this event, they all make sense, but they only make sense in this moment of breaking this bread. There's something about the giving of his giving of himself that causes all of these things to fall together. I don't know if you all have seen the movie The Usual Suspects, and I won't give it away to anybody, but at the very end of the movie, there's this moment that happens where this person is, this whole movie, this person's been interrogated, and then at the very last scene, this person looks around the room and sees all of these things in the room that he hadn't noticed before. As the person that he's been interrogating is leaving, and there's this image of his cup falling out of his hand because all of a sudden all the pieces are just coming together. And you as a viewer realize in that moment that, oh my gosh, this is what I've been seeing this whole time and I didn't know it. And I've been taken on this journey, and now this is the linchpin that kind of pulls it all together, and now I know what I didn't know. Mm. And that's kind of how I imagine, or how I'm thinking about these events. And the Eucharist, I just to circle back to Althea's question, the Eucharist being that event or that action that helps you to see it from that angle. It's not just an empty tomb, which it might otherwise be, because we return to it, bring it to ourselves, celebrate it in this way, and this is where we see the significance of that event or something along those lines. Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting conversation to have. And yes, in a sense, we're strayed a long way from the texts that we have. And this might also be liminality, that it feels very close to the texts. It feels like a translexical moment where we're indwelling the words, but indwelling them richly. Mm. And as Deirdre discussed at the beginning, these are the texts that end Epiphany and launch us on the journey to Easter. So in a sense, they too are liminal texts. Mm-hmm. And as you have both been describing it, I'm hearing us thinking about the culmination at Easter, hearing the beginning of a journey where we get to that place on Easter Sunday, and we look back and we say, this is what it has all been about. Now we can see. So are we contributing a framing of the Lenten period as a protracted liminal experience, where we're moving through so much of our ordinariness, and because of our liturgical calendar, we can indeed anticipate that there's going to be that epiphanic moment. But can we also be conscious that we're inside this space if to the extent that we frame our lives in terms of liturgical calendar, that we are in this liminal space where our ordinariness awaits a kind of transposition?
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
It. Can we please end on that note?
Oh my gosh.
I want to honor it by ending on it. Can we do that, please?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much. I look forward to our next conversation. And Althea, thank you so much for that epiphanic conclusion.
Okay.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.